working to prevent sexual assault and overcoming the broader rape culture. There's been a lot of outrage in social media and the traditional press over recent rape cases in the news, from the trial of a former Stanford athlete who sexually assaulted an unconscious woman behind a dumpster, to the gang rape of a 16-year-old girl in Brazil, which was videotaped and posted on YouTube. But for every case that garners international headlines, there are thousands more that do not. According to statistics compiled by the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence, 1 in 5 women in the U.S. has been raped in her lifetime. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we'll talk about the reasons behind these sobering numbers and efforts to change what has become known as the rape culture in our society. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the MPBN studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. The public outcry over the recent sexual assault case at Stanford prompted conversations across the country about the topic of rape. One alarming development is the sense that our society has certain cultural norms that lead to rape, whether it's alcohol abuse, athletics, or gender, or class entitlement. We'll talk about what leads to this so-called rape culture and what can be done to change it. With me in our studio, Shana Nadelson, Executive Director of Speak About It, a Portland nonprofit that focuses on education and sexual assault prevention for students across the country and around the world. Doris Santoro is Associate Professor of Education at Bowdoin College and the Chair of the Gender, Sexuality, and Women's Studies Program. Mark Tappan is Professor and Chair of the Education Program at Colby College and teaches Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies. And as always, we want to hear from you in the audience. What do you think leads to the prevalence of sexual assault in our country? The phone number, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Thank you all for joining me today.
Absolutely. Thank happy you. To be here.
Glad to be here.
I want to start by talking about the phrase rape culture. Just in the past few weeks, it seems to have really become part of the national conversation in a way that it wasn't before. But what does it mean? And I guess I'll start with you, Doris. What is rape culture?
Well, one thing I'll just start by saying is that I am not the chair of the Gender, Sexuality, and Women's Studies program. I am, as of Friday, the chair of the Education Department.
Oh, I'm sorry. Bowdoin. Oh, congratulations.
No, thank you, I think. But I do teach a course in the Gender, Sexuality, and Women's Studies program at Bowdoin. And so rape culture is not a term that I have used in the past. It is something that is relatively new to me, but it is also a phrase that makes perfect sense to me. Because what I take from that is the idea that there is an entitlement to other people's bodies, and that we live in a culture where people are taught to take what they want, accept no dialogue, act unilaterally. And I think we could think about rape culture in terms of individuals' bodies, but we could also think about it in terms of the environment. You know, and so I don't want to take us away from the very real connection this has to sexual violence, but I think also that rape culture is an idea that is supported by all kinds of attitudes towards other people that is completely based on individual will rather than engaging in forms of interdependence.
All right, Mark Tappan, you're nodding as Doris speaks.
I would agree with that. I would also say add a couple of other points. One of the things that rape culture entails, as far as I'm concerned, is objectification or kind of sexualizing, particularly of women. And women's bodies, and sort of turning, as Doris was suggesting, sort of turning humans into objects. And that happens through language and through images and messages from the media and elsewhere. It starts very early particularly if we're thinking about boys learning about how to sexualize or objectify women. It happens with early media messages. And the other thing I would add is rape culture entails a kind of normalization of sexual harassment or sort of low levels of sexual violence. Again, language, name-calling, kind of inappropriate touching that can sort of, again, send the messages Doris was suggesting that some folks are entitled to sort of possess or, you know, have their way with the bodies of others.
Shana, when you hear this phrase rape culture, what do you think of it? And what about the young people you interact with? Not that you're not a young person yourself, but tell me about the phrase in terms of the work you do.
I'd love to be the young fun voice in this conversation, hopefully the fun one. It's difficult, right? We're talking about rape culture, and those two words together have become quite a buzzword, especially when we talk about campus sexual assaults. You know, it's been all over the news the past year or so, high school, college, sexual assault. And so I think when we talk about rape culture, we're referring to the phenomenon that this isn't occurring out of thin air. This isn't a one and done type of situation. It's not like these stories are outliers. And it's also not that these stories are new. This has been happening for years and years and years, and we're just now starting to talk about it. And so when I think about rape culture, we're thinking about what's happening before these assaults. What, you know, a lot of stuff that the work that Doris and Mark do, the objectification, talking about gender dynamics and media and what are we taught and how are we taught it. All this happens before a sexual assault. And then after, and how are we treating the survivors and who are those survivors? What do they look like? I'm referring to survivors of sexual assault. Some people will say victims. We speak about it like survivors. So what's happening after? Where's the shame around this? And how are we treating both the perpetrators, or the alleged perpetrators, and the survivors? And how do we as a culture respond in the aftermath?
Do you think this phrase has come up, especially in terms of the Stanford rape case? Because a lot of people were asking the question, how can we get to a place where a 19-year-old boy, it even occurs to him to do such a thing? That's the sort of the seed of this conversation, sort of this national disbelief of where did we get, how did we get here?
I don't think it's entirely accurate to look at it like, how did it occur to this person? I think these seeds have been planted along the way, and this just was kind of the perfect storm of privilege and athletics and masculinity and alcohol and entitlement and thinking you're going to get away with it kind of all happening at once.
I think it's wrong to imagine that this is a problem that occurs or begins to occur in college, and that this happened, you know, that there was a moment at age 19 that one person came up with this idea or was taken over by this kind of action. This and that's what I connect with, and when I hear rape culture, is that it's about that it is about a set of beliefs and practices that we engage in as a society. This isn't about individuals who then act, although it is the individuals who do act, but we also need to be accountable as a society about what kind of messages we're sending, what kinds of information we're sharing, what kind of behaviors we think are acceptable all over the place. And I think that I see this idea happening even as early as middle school and high school, even when we talk about sexual education. And we have examples of sexual education that are based on what's called abstinence only, that's prevalent in many schools. And in fact, the U.S. government funds these programs, spends millions of dollars each year to support. I think the 2016 number is something like $85 million a year to support abstinence education. And what this does is some of the materials that are purchased with U.S. dollars send messages like boys can't control themselves. Once they hit a certain point, they are out of their own control, and so therefore are not responsible for their own behavior. That girls are responsible for putting on the brakes And then we also end up in a situation where any kind of survivor, because it's so pathologized to be sexually active in any kind of way, end up feeling like they have nowhere to go.
Well, you're hitting on what Elizabeth Smart is talking about, the kidnapping victim who's publicly come out and said that when you have, in her case, the Mormon faith, but many faiths in this country that value purity, and there's some sort of shame in that lost that purity, that you're you know, she is speaking to exactly what you're talking about, Doris, is that it's beyond, in her case, sexual education in school, but that if one is not abstinent, they're somehow dirty as a teenager.
Absolutely. But I think it's also important for us to recognize that it's not just about the individual choices that people make or even religious groups that may be offering particular perspectives, but that our elected officials are providing money to support this kind of message.
Yeah, and the other thing I would just add, going back to the point about rape culture and the current conversation, is that there's a real tension between sort of our looking for individual responsibility and holding, you know, perpetrators responsible, but also sort of understanding that the culture has a responsibility too. And I think that dynamic, that tension, is part of the current conversation, and it has to be a balance, you know. If you just focus on the culture, then it can be a way to kind of let folks off the hook. If you focus just on the individual perpetrators or survivors, then it's, you know, focusing only on somebody making bad choices and not recognizing the role of the culture. So it's a both and understanding that relationship is really critical, as far as I'm concerned, in understanding this whole set of issues.
I'm going to bring up a point that our producer, Jonathan Smith, has made over and over again when we've talked about this issue. So the widely cited statistic is that 1 in 5 women will be raped in her lifetime. But somehow that doesn't seem to be regarded as a national or international emergency. I think of how people responding to Ebola or the Zika fly, if there were a communicable disease affecting 1 in 5 women, imagine the response. Why is this different?
We've been saying this for years, is that if you were to send your children to college and say 1 in 5 laptops would be stolen, people would flip out. College Humor actually did a really great video about people being attacked by bears, 1 in 5 people being attacked by bears. People would lose it. And there's something about this that says, A, my kid would never do that, and B, this would never happen to my kid. That you never want to think that this is going to be so personalized. And we say this with Speak About It, that we do this work because everyone has a story about sexual assault. Mm-hmm. That if you gather with a group of friends and you talk about sexual assault, there were going to be survivors in that room. There are going to be partners of survivors. There are going to be siblings. And this is the first time in ever, really, that we are finally talking about this. And Mark touched on this. Instead of focusing on these individual survivors, this is systemic. This has been going on college campuses, and that's, I will say that because that's where we focus a lot of our work. This has been going on college campuses for years, and it's only now that survivors are starting to talk about it and realizing that they're not alone. You know, Doris was talking about the abstinence-only education and the shame around being sexually active. So you've got the shame of being sexually active coupled with being in a situation where you have control taken from you and where you should have known better and you should have been able to protect yourself to be able to admit that you maybe made a wrong decision. I'm not saying that a survivor has, but that's what we're saying culturally. That's what our rape culture is saying, that you couldn't protect yourself. You made a wrong decision. And so now there's like this compounded shame around sex and sexual activity and not having power.
I want to go back just to the perpetrators for a second, too, because that's what I've been thinking in recent days, is these perpetrators are sitting in my class, too. Mm. And that's something that I've been really thinking about. And what does that mean? I think often about the young women who are sitting in my class or in my office, and often I might talk to them about their past experiences, or they might share it with me after they graduate. But I've been, and so I'm not saying that's not important, but that's something that's on my mind a lot. But I've just recently been thinking about that the perpetrators are also in my class.
What do we know about perpetrators? It seems to me as though there are some people who, I'm trying to think of some of the reading I've done over the last few months, that there are, even though one in five women will be raped in her lifetime, it's not that one in five men is a rapist, that the perpetrators have multiple victims. What do we know about the numbers of the percentage? Do we know?
Well, I think it's, I mean, I think sort of the jury's still out because there's some research that suggests it's more sort of a serial rapist. It's sort of more limited number of folks who are raping again and again and again or sexual assault. There's other evidence that suggests it is sort of not just serial folks, but other people involved. So I think we need more data on that. But at least from my point of view, I don't think we have a definitive answer to that.
I think the important thing is just to remember that mostly on college campuses, it's college students raping other college students.
The most recent statistic I read on that was that 70% of college survivors know their perpetrator. Yeah. I remember reading something recently about someone suggested that college women should be able to carry handguns so that they don't get raped. And then this statistic says, yeah, but the person who might be sexually assaulting you is someone you've had a class with, is your partner, is the person who lives down the hall. And the inclination to be able to defend yourself in that way isn't going to happen because that's not who these people are for the most part.
Well,
and to go – oh, sorry.
No, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say just when we think about perpetrators, we try to take some of the focus away from who are these people and how many times is it happening and who's doing it and why – and turn it back to focusing on healthy sexuality. And what does a healthy sexual encounter look like? And how do we have that communication and take care of our partners, not so that we're not necessarily not labeled rapists, and I'm using air quotes here, but so that people are enjoying what's happening. And obviously, you know, the conversation about sexual assault is happening, but we want to change this and make it more about healthy sexuality and shift the attention to that.
And I think that's critical. And sort of back to Doris's point about sex education, the other concept that should be a part of this conversation, at least on college campuses, is what's called the hookup culture. And that is absolutely about the way in which current generation of young folks think about sexual experience and sexual relationships. And it's very, there's lots of work that needs to be done around that. My sense from my students is folks are really hungry for an honest conversation about sexuality and relationships, and they have all kinds of questions, and there's not a lot of opportunity for those conversations. You know, the most popular course at UMO or Orno is taught by Sandy Caron on human sexuality, and so, you know, I think that's a key effort.
That's a key indicator. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, if it's the most popular place. We have to take a break. We'll continue this conversation on Maine Calling about the rape culture, about having conversations and moving our culture beyond this place. The phone number 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Our email talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Snow Pond Center for the Arts, celebrating its 80th summer, announcing its summer music series. Tickets and subscriptions available at snowpond.org. And the law firm of Eaton Peabody, statewide practice, local service, with offices in Augusta, Bangor, Brunswick, Ellsworth, and Portland.
Tens of thousands say they'll gather in central London today to protest the decision by UK voters to leave the European Union. We check in with our correspondent on the mood there, and we'll get the latest from Brussels, where EU leaders gather to plan for the UK's exit from the Union amid calls to speed that process. That's later today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 each weekday evening here on Maine Public Radio. This day in Maine, quite a bit happens around Maine each day, and it often affects our lives. And we want to know about it. Maine Public Radio reports daily on the issues, events, and ideas that shape our state, and you can hear that reporting throughout the day right here on Maine Public Radio. Or, if you're not able to listen 24 hours a day, try This Day in Maine. You'll find it online at mpbn.net, updated each evening around 7, with all the day's Maine news in one place for streaming or as a podcast. It's also available in the iTunes Store.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Sexual Assault and What Leads to Rape Culture. With me in our studio, Doris Santoro, the soon-to-be chair of the education department at
Bowdoin College.
Sorry, it's not my notes right here. Mark Tappan teaches women's gender and sexuality studies at Colby College. Shayna Nadelson is executive director of Speak About It, teaching sexual assault prevention to students and starting conversations about healthy sexuality. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Before we went to the break, everybody wanted to jump in, and I had to go to a break. We were talking about this whole idea of a hookup culture and also about students being thirsty for a conversation. Shayna.
I got so excited. I was raising my hand in the studio. I think in my tiny consent educator sexual assault prevention heart, I want to change the conversation about how and why we talk about consent away from get this thing so you don't get in trouble towards let's talk about what we want and changing the conversation. It was a big deal. The no means no style of consent is kind of out the window. This go until you hear stop. It's now widely a yes means yes or enthusiastic consent, which says don't start until you hear yes, which is fantastic. But we're still so focused on not getting in trouble. And if I could wish upon a unicorn star, I would wish that we would change this conversation to be about pleasure, to say, what do you enjoy and how do we get there? And, you know, I don't think the hookup culture is inherently bad, but there's no conversation about pleasure in a hookup culture.
Doris.
I have been really trying to understand hookup culture. So I am, I started this spring, a podcast called Embodying the Liberal Arts Office Hours at Bowdoin. www.embodyingliberalarts.com, also available on iTunes.
Well
and
done.
So, thanks. And you know, so sometimes we end up talking about relationships and how satisfied students are about the relationships that they're in or having or sexual experiences that they're having. And for me, you know, I initially thought of hookup culture, you know, as sort of an older person observing from the outside. It doesn't mean just promiscuity. And that is interesting to me. I see this hookup culture as a way of compartmentalizing sexuality. That I am so, and at least at Bowdoin, it is, I am so busy, I have so much to achieve, I have to do these things. And so I am going to put my orgasms, my sexuality, my pleasure with my own body and other people's bodies into a little box. And every once in a while, I can visit it, but we will not be outside of that box. And that seems to me almost a part of binge culture of that I've got it all together all the rest of the time, but once in a while I'll allow this other thing to happen, which seems so not pleasurable to me and seems really unsatisfying. And I don't know the ways that that may or may not connect to rape culture, but I just see that sort of cordoning off and not integrating sexuality into a full life as really missing an important part of what it means to be human. And in terms of the talking about, speaking about it or talking about it, I've realized, and this was particularly after I read the Stanford survivor's letter, which is amazing, I realize that I need to be talking in my classes more about sexuality and about sexual violence. I have no problems talking about other things that people are afraid to talk about, but need safe spaces and permission to talk about, like racism or classism or all kinds of other things. And I realize that I need to create more space for this because it's important and we need to have honest and safe conversations about it.
So many interesting comments on Facebook and email. I want to get to some of these. Rick on Facebook says, rape culture? What happened to rape as a crime of violence as opposed to one motivated by sexual urges? Rape culture makes it sound as if we're softening the edges considerably here. Thoughts?
I disagree. I actually think that it indicts all of us.
Well, it suggests, in fact, absolutely, that we live in a culture of violence. And, you know, violence, as we've seen tragically, not only in terms of sexual assault, but, you know, gun violence in Orlando and others, you know, we live in a very violent society, very violent culture, and sort of connecting those dots around, you know, the ways in which some men feel entitled to sort of enact their rage or their urges on others is part of the conversation. So it's absolutely, violence is a central part of the conversation as a cultural phenomenon, not just an individual phenomenon.
And Mark, your comments related to Kim on Facebook, who writes, I'm really concerned about gender-based violence and threats of violence surrounding political discourse, she writes. How do we make sure politics and the larger public realm are not hostile, violent, threatening spaces for women? From the shooting of Gabby Giffords to the hate tweets toward women policymakers in Seattle to the endless vitriols towards Secretary Clinton, I think rape culture is shaping the public square in particularly terrible ways, and I'm curious how we best respond, intervene, and change it.
Oh, we could do a whole show on that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. About what's happening in politics right now.
I mean, part of the for me, part of it is that, and part of what I think is good news in the face of a lot of bad news, is that, you know, more and more men are very publicly stepping up and saying, you know, this is our responsibility, and, you know, we have to have this conversation, from President Obama and Vice President Biden to other leaders in the men's movement, and others are really saying, you know, men have a role to play in addressing this issue and stepping up and you know, taking an ethical stand.
And I will go to go ahead. I was going to say, I will go to the calls in just a minute. We have so many interesting Facebook posts and emails, though. I'm going to stick with those for a little bit. But go ahead, Shana.
I was going to say briefly the vein that I hear similar between those two Facebook posts is that we're talking about power and inequality.
Right.
And there are groups of power and there are people with less power. And that until this becomes equal, this conversation is going to continue. Sexual violence, politics, et cetera. It's absurd that Hillary's the first nominee at this point, and racism. And if there's, anyway, yes.
Okay. Sandy on Facebook, pornography. Most males are addicted to it in this country, and rape is such a common theme. This influences male thoughts of sexuality in a big way. Why is this okay? I'm not sure about Sandy saying most males are addicted to it. Is that true?
I mean, I think you could probably say that everybody watches porn. I think that there are certainly porn addicts out there. I don't know about that. Most men are. But I think that's where a lot of people get their sex education, that if they're receiving abstinence-only education, people are turning to porn because it's accessible. And that's not what people look like, and that's not how people are sexual beings, and that is problematic.
All right, so this is an email from Beth, who's a lawyer in Kennebunkport. Shouldn't the state's instruments of enforcement, police, prosecutors, courts, be held accountable for their part in this? Unlike robbery, for example, whether the victim is telling the truth is often the central question when the victim comes forward. I think I read that awkwardly, but I think she means when someone's robbed, there's no question whether the victim is telling the truth. Consequently, as reported in the book Missoula, the difference between the number of rapes reported versus those prosecuted during any given year is disturbingly low. Is there any effort in Maine to pressure and examine and disclosure of those statistics, which are after all, part of rape culture? How many reported versus how many prosecuted on a county-by-county basis?
That is a very, very difficult answer because sexual assault is so underreported, and I like that this person gave an example of robbery. If someone reports a robbery, you say, okay, let's investigate it. You don't take that person to the hospital and conduct very long, invasive exams and ask questions about what they were wearing and how much they had to drink. And I think that's part of the process of what's happening, is that we need to believe survivors up front. When someone's car gets broken into, the first question is, well, where did you park it? Why did you park it there? Why do you have a fancy car if you don't want someone to break into it?
And we've had, as happening all over the country, very difficult conversations at Colby this year about this very issue. And the thing that came up in public conversations, the primary wish and hope from survivors was that we listen to them, and that you know, we take them seriously, we believe them, and that you know, that folks said would go a long way to at least within our campus culture changing the dynamic. So that's really key.
Okay, go ahead. We're going to have Chad and Winslow next, but first go ahead, Doris.
I just wanted to talk about that idea of voice in response to these, in response to surviving a sexual assault and sexual violence. You know, I've heard people talking about the Stanford Survivor's Letter as, and comparing it to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s letter from a Birmingham jail. I actually think that this is an even more important statement. And that's because most survivors have no voice. And to be able to so articulately, and I couldn't say articulately, describe the experience and this sort of invasion of a person's selfhood and humanity, and to just take apart bit by bit the arguments that we normally work with, that was so not only incredibly truthful and analytic, but it also gave voice to the voiceless.
Okay. Chad, as promised, you're on Maine Calling. Go ahead.
Thanks, Jennifer. I'm listening to this conversation today about rape culture, and it seems like the focus is very much on women being the victims of this and men the perpetrators, which is, you know, that's accurate, that's real, and one in five women being raped in her lifetime. What I wanted to add to the conversation is that one in six American adult men report having been sexually assaulted in childhood, and that seems to me to be a part of the whole rape culture, if that's what we're going to call it, and a fertile ground for where adult rapists come from. And I just thought I'd throw that out and see what your panel might have to say about it.
Shana.
I'm nodding that your statistics are accurate, and thank you for, as far as I know, your statistics are accurate, and thank you for bringing that to the conversation. I don't know if there's any real connection between childhood survivors and then future perpetrators, but when we think about growing up and having a relationship with power, and when power is taken away, what does that teach young people about the relationships they should have around sex and sexuality and power? And so I don't know if that is a true correlation, but based on this conversation, I wouldn't be surprised.
And the other connection is just the silencing of that experience, and that carries through that we've been talking about silencing around other dimensions of this too, so that certainly has an impact.
It seems to me that, and maybe this is because of our choice of panel here today, that we're talking about efforts and younger men, especially college age students. Are the majority of these cases among this age group, or is it just that right now this is where the efforts to try to change things are focused?
I think that's yes. I think when you look at college, it's kind of the perfect storm of when all this happens, that it's getting harder and harder to get into college now. So people are doing more and they're in clubs and playing sports and taking hard classes. They get to college. You're trying to have good grades and do it all and be social. And now you are living alone often for the first time on residential campuses. And you have access to alcohol probably for the first time in kind of an unrestricted way. And then we're talking about hookup culture and this autonomy and this privilege and this accessibility, I think, it really makes college the perfect storm for this conversation to be happening.
We have an email from Mark. Is there a difference in the crime between a rapist who sneaks into a woman's house, holds a knife to her throat and attacks her, and the date rape where she says no and he proceeds anyway?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
She wants to know, Mark emails, is there a difference for this, the sake of this conversation, between somebody who breaks into someone's home, holds a knife to her throat and attacks her, and the so-called date rape where somebody says no and he proceeds anyway?
I don't think so. I think it's this, the legal statute covers the same.
And I think it's, I wonder, I'm not sure if this is what Mark means, but is there a different sort of, is there something else going on for the rapist in those situations? And I think that those situations are both about power and both about violence.
The one thing I'll add to that is that I want to just remind everyone that when we talk about sexual assault, we're talking about sexual assault as an umbrella term, and it's not necessarily penetrative rape. It's not necessarily what we think of as only heterosexual, heteronormative, penetrative rape. That if we talk about assault, we're talking about any time there was sexual activity where consent wasn't given. And so that's going to be different for different people. And the worst thing that's ever happened to someone is the worst thing that's ever happened to someone. I'm going to take a quick chance to plug the Maine Coalition Against Sexual Assault. If you are a survivor of sexual assault and you'd like to talk to someone about your experience, the Maine Coalition Against Sexual Assault is fantastic. I will get their number at the break, and we'll make sure that it's on all the social media.
But even by the traditional old-fashioned definition of rape, the word you use, penetrative, it's still one in five women. That's the information I have from the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence. There's separate set of statistics for sexual assault and sexual violence.
The statistics I can speak to is that one in five college-age women will experience attempted or completed sexual assault.
Okay. We're going to take another short break. When we return, more of your comments and questions. Please stay with us.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Lincoln Health Wound Care Center, a 2016 recipient of the Healogics Center of Distinction for Clinical Excellence. Sweetser, offering mental health first aid classes in several Maine locations. Course description and class schedule at sweetser.org. And Northeast Delta Dental. Dental benefits for businesses of all sizes, including individual and family plans. Details at northeastdeltadental.com. If you don't want to stream our new Maine Public Classical channel and perhaps can't hear or hear as well as you'd like any of our growing FM over-the-air classical network, we've got so far at 106.1 Bangor, 99.7 Waterville, 91.5 Freiburg, and 104.1 Portland, there's a good chance you can listen with HD radio. With a special HD receiver, you can hear Maine Public Classical wherever you hear Maine Public Radio. And very often, you can easily plug the HD receiver into your existing home stereo. We have information about HD radio, what it is, how to listen, how to purchase a receiver, online at mpbn.net. And thanks. Coming up at 2 o'clock, in just a few minutes, we'll have the Commonwealth Club of California. We'll hear a discussion on driving innovation and unleashing the power of clean energy to transform our world. That's coming up on the Commonwealth Club of California at 2 o'clock, right here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, what's being done to address and prevent not only sexual assault, but the rape culture. With me in our studio, Mark Tappan, a professor and chair of the education program at Colby College. Shana Nadelson, executive director of Speak About It. Doris Santoro, associate professor of education at Bowdoin College. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Here's an email from Sean, who is an educator at the Sexual Assault Crisis and Support Center. He says, another reason we don't freak out about the one in five statistic is that we've been fed the stereotypical story of how, when, why a sexual assault happens. Think of Lifetime movies back in the day. That can fuel the whole, quote, that will never happen to me idea. If you don't fit the stereotype of the victim, aren't in the stereotypical places, it happens, doesn't happen to you.
Thank you for that.
I just wanted to add one other piece to this, especially at a time when we're talking about crime and violence and where that comes from in our community. The majority of sexual assaults are committed by white men.
Is that one of the statistics that we know to be true?
Yes.
Or that it's because most of the cases that are reported are against white men?
I can't answer that question. I wouldn't be able to speak to that, but at least the cases that we have that we know are reported are about white men.
Okay, we're going to go to Carlin in Portland. Hi, Carlin. Go ahead.
Hi there. I love this conversation. I think it's really important to have it among allies because it can better kind of focus our efforts. My question is about in the panelists' experience. How do us non-professionals best have these conversations with those that need to hear it the most? Not just hear it, but like integrate it into their own understanding. Where, how, and why are these light bulb moments happening in those folks? And how can the rest of us replicate them?
Well, what the, That's a great question, and there are lots of ways. One way that I've been thinking about with my colleagues, Lynn Brown, Sharon Lamb, we studied boys' media and really suggested that parents and caregivers starting very young can, with boys who are very young, can have conversations about the media messages that boys get and to do a kind of homegrown media literacy where stereotypes are highlighted and conversations about the kinds of messages that start very early around, male entitlement and male privilege is an important and really powerful way to have those conversations anywhere with young people and particularly young boys.
Doris.
So I have a 6-year-old daughter, and I'm really interested in helping her to develop a sexual health, a healthy sexual life. And the other night we were watching Moonrise Kingdom, and in that there are 11 and 12, the main characters. And, you know, there was a situation where my parents would have turned off the television, you know, because the boy asks the girl if he can touch her chest. And then she asks him if they can French kiss. And he needs a little bit more information about what French kissing is, but then they go ahead and do it. And I loved that. And I want my daughter to see that because it was a very organic, let me check in with you. Is this something okay for you to do? They both received pleasure from it, and they were okay saying, I don't know what that is. Give me more information. Oh, okay, yeah, I'm all right going along with that. And that's the kind of agency I want my daughter to have.
And the powerful conversation between you and your daughter in a safe space has got to have a really important effect on her. So
I was just going to kind of add on to both of those is that you don't need like a formal curriculum to talk to your people, not even your children. Talk to your partners, your friends. Go to a superhero movie. Talk about what it says about masculinity. Hear a song on the radio. How does this make you feel? Do you agree with this? You don't have to have a formal curriculum. It can be casual conversations.
Yeah, the media is a curriculum for everyone, everywhere.
All right, Carlin, thanks for bringing up an interesting part of the conversation. Susan on Facebook quotes this same book, Missoula. She quotes, women don't get raped because they were drinking or took drugs. Women do not get raped because they weren't careful enough. Women get raped because somebody raped them. And I guess it's called The Purity Myth by Jessica Valenti. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Again, related to what you were talking about, teaching abstinence, related to the speaking out by Elizabeth Smart. We have an email that says, this may be outside the timeline of the conversation. As a woman in my early 60s, but while a student at the University of Maine and a student at Colby, I was harassed, stalked, and accosted by two different professors of classes I was enrolled in. It was made clear I could comply and get the benefits of a very good grade. I took the decline in my GPA instead. I felt as a female I had somehow been responsible for what had happened. Only long after, while listening to Anita Hill, did the term sexual harassment create a new truth for my experiences. I realized many female students may have been afraid to suffer demoted grades. Our culture has evolved over the decades, but I just wanted to acknowledge Anita Hill and her courage during the Clarence Thomas trial in making some groundbreaking promise in the role of women and being viewed as commodities by males in authority. I pray all schools provide accommodations for all students to address sexual violence.
I'm going to take a quick opportunity to follow up with the Maine Coalition Against Sexual Assault. Their phone number, 1-800-871-7741. If you've been a victim or survivor of sexual assault, sexual harassment, you can call the Maine Coalition Against Sexual Assault.
And we'll also put that on our MPBN Maine Calling Facebook page if it's not there already.
I have been harassed in the way that the person who just wrote on an email or Facebook. I mean, so not at Bowdoin, but in other professional arenas. I work in a male-dominated field of philosophy and education, and there have been a number of times where there were unwanted sexual advances and all kinds of quid pro quo that were brought up. And so I think that this, again, connects to the idea of rape culture. And while I don't want to equate sexual harassment with sexual violence, I think this idea has very deep roots that are connected to women's bodies as available to men, but this doesn't have to be just about men and women. It can be any time we see that someone else does not deserve the same kind of humanity and recognition of their agency as others.
And it goes back to the example goes back to power. It's connected to male privilege, male entitlement, and you know, one of the things that happens in male culture in the patriarchy is not only privilege and entitlement, but men learn that they have to be silent to protect each other. And so in those cases, there were certainly, I can't imagine there were not other men who knew what was going on. And men just have to sort of resist those pressures to be part of the be among one of the guys.
Boys club, yeah.
Boys club, and to step up and to have the courage to speak out and say, hey, this isn't okay. And there are lots of men out there who feel that way. But, you know, I think we're in a time where more and more men are recognizing that's, you know, our role as men is to step up and speak out.
So you're saying that there would be men who would be discouraged or fearful of speaking out because it might harm their own careers to speak out against a colleague.
Absolutely. Or, yeah, I mean, be shamed, be pressured in a variety of ways. And, you know, I think that's changing, but it's still, there's boys learn early that, you know, they got to go along with the guys.
Well, we're also talking a little bit about bystander intervention. And what does that mean to be there and be at the party and see this happening? And one of my favorite things to say specifically to male athletes right now is you're going out, you're hanging out, you're with your teammates, you want to win a championship. It's going to be really hard to win a championship without your star quarterback if that person's assaulted someone. So jump in and take care of each other and make a plan and watch out. And you don't have to, you know, you have this amazing power as a friend to step in and say something before it gets to that point, before we're trying to get into that club.
An email from Anne. She writes, more than most European cultures, America remains trapped in a puritanical view of human sexuality. We may no longer burn people at the stake, but we continue to place women on a stake of humility if they express their sexuality with confidence.
Cheers.
Word.
Absolutely. Your turn, Mark.
How can I follow that? I mean, that is a common conversation on our campus that, you know, men are valorized for their sexual exploits and women are shamed for theirs. So the women are called all kinds of negative terms for, you know, having sexual desires and being involved in sexual relationships, and men, you know, compare notes and get the kudos for the same thing. So it's absolutely a double standard that is part of the problem.
Well, and this also spills over to the dress code, the double standard
absolutely.
About dress code. I mean, even in a place that's, even at a school that doesn't have a dress code, or even in a community that doesn't have a dress code, it's still okay for a guy to go running without a shirt on, and it's not mm-hmm. okay for a woman to go running yes. without a shirt on, or a construction worker to work without a shirt on.
It's actually legal, but people gawk. Mm-hmm. It's legal definitely in Portland, maybe in the state of Maine, for women to be topless, but it's... Mm-hmm. not socially acceptable yet.
And in many public high schools, girls have been pushing back. And I recently just spoke to a girl from Portland Public Schools who was taking it up with their school leadership about the differential requirements for their clothing, not with uniforms, but just in terms of what is allowed to show and not, and what kind of shaming happens due to body.
Okay, I think we have time for one more call. We're going to go to Sheena, who's calling from Casco. Hi, Sheena, go ahead.
Hi. This question is actually directed toward the two folks from Colby and Bowdoin, where I graduated as one of the first women's class at Bowdoin, actually in 1973. But what I wonder is, if a woman reports sexual violence, a woman on campus, to the authorities at Bowdoin, do they immediately... assist her in contacting the police and reporting a crime, or is there an in-house adjudication that happens or may happen either at Colby or Bowdoin?
That option is immediately presented to the student who approaches whomever they discuss this with. So we have a number of people whom they can approach, or if... let's say a student approached me, I would say, this is something I must report, and and how do you want to handle this going forward?
Yeah, all faculty, staff, anybody employed at a college like Colby or Bowdoin is called a responsible employee, and we have to report to the Title IX coordinator and official at the college about incidents that we hear about. And then, but also at Colby, students who are reporting then have a choice. They're given the choice of several different options within the college disciplinary process, and then also absolutely always have a choice to go to the police.
We're in the middle of a change, though, aren't we? We're going. It seems to me as though we're shifting from a place where colleges handled this. It had a Title IX officer to. I think in the future, and correct me if I'm wrong, there's going to be acknowledgement that this is something for police. This is if you're raped, it's a case for police.
I still think it's the option of the survivor to contact the police. It's not about the cover-up. It's about the agency of the survivor and what do they get to choose so they can take some of their power back.
Absolutely.
I know this question wasn't for me, but I'm just going to quickly add that if you are not a professor and someone discloses to you that they have been sexually assaulted, that's a huge deal. And to support and believe that survivor can go a huge and very long way in their healing process. And you don't necessarily have any responsibility to report the way Doris or Mark would, but it's a really powerful thing to be that first person that someone discloses to.
Well, Shana, let's end with this really practical information. If somebody comes to you and says, if one of your friends says, this happened to me, what do you do?
The best thing you can do is believe them and ask what you can do. I'm sorry. How, you know, what do you need now? How can I help you now? You don't want to say it'll be okay, you'll be fine, because you can't promise that. The biggest thing you can do is believe them and then find someone who can help. So whether it's pointing your friend towards the Maine Coalition Against Sexual Assault, continuing the conversation, watching a movie, going for a walk on the Eastern Prom, it's whatever that person needs in that. And I appreciate the opportunity to kind of close this out. I would say that the biggest thing that you can do as a listener after this show, we only covered a little bit. We hit the tip of the iceberg. Continue this conversation. Keep talking about this. What does it mean? What does rape culture mean to you? What does it mean in your friend circles, in your family circles? How can you change it?
All right.
Continue.
Well, you guys are...
10 seconds. Read the Stanford Survivor's Letter online. Mm. It's very, very powerful.
Well, thank you all. What a terrific conversation, an important conversation, I think. Mark Tappan, a professor and chair of the education program at Colby College, who also teaches women's gender and sexuality studies. Doris Santoro, associate professor of education at Bowdoin College, and teaches gender, sexuality, and women's studies. Shana Nadelson, executive director of Speak About It, a Portland nonprofit that teaches students about sexual assault prevention. Nikki Shields ran the board today. Hannah McCool answered your calls. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as a link to our audio archives, by visiting mainecalling.net. Today's program will be rebroadcast this evening at 8. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, a conversation about the latest political and economic news in Maine and the nation, including Trump's visit and Brexit's impact. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.